So members of this community have been educating themselves in the history of Indigenous people in the class Truth, Healing, and Reconciliation that was created by Canadian Unitarians, Meg Roberts, Samaya Oakley, Amber Bellamar, Casey Stainsby, and Leslie Kemp, to honor that Unitarian commitment to make made at the end of the Truth, Healing, and Reconciliation process. We acknowledge that the work of reconciliation continues. For their perspectives, I first invite Peggy Lunderville to come and share her experience, followed by A.J. Vitti.
Good morning. I took a little bit broader point of view, but I did reflect on our experiences in the course. Differing worldviews was the topic. Every day I'm confronted with these. Today, my focus is on the difference between my worldview and the Indigenous worldview, based on my experience of the Truth, Healing, and Reconciliation course presented by Beacon, and which I was fortunate to be able to attend. And then I'll give some examples that are from a slightly different perspective as well. The first one was the blanket exercise. It was very telling. If you don't know what that is, ask about it. It's very interesting. It brings out the connection to the land felt by the descendants of those who lived on this land unimpeded by settlers. From the discussion of roots, I started to question my own connection to the land. I grew up in a small town in northern Quebec, and this is the land that has my roots. However, my roots there are personal to me and not to the family that birthed me. I would have to classify my family as nomads, even when they lived in Europe, and they are also newcomers to Canada on my mother's side in the late 1800s and on my father's side in the 1920s. We're a restless bunch, and even now I'm far from Quebec. The other question on roots that arose for me from the discussions was, where were the Indigenous people of northern Quebec when I was growing up? I never thought about it at the time. This was a territory inhabited by Innu, according to the map we were given in the course, but this is a question that I still have not answered. As settlers and newcomers, we owe powerful thank yous to the Indigenous that made room for us, whether willingly or unwillingly. As we continued in learning about the uncensored point of view of various Indigenous writers and speakers, it became apparent that there is much of truth-telling that remains to be done. And for truth to be told, there has to be a listening ear. This process promises to be painful and lengthy. I believe we are only still at the beginnings of truth-telling, and we are far from healing and reconciliation. All of this brings me to the struggle over the Kinder Morgan pipeline, which is very much a struggle over worldviews. Since the Truth, Healing, and Reconciliation training, my perspective on this has shifted. I now see the gross discrepancy in the federal talk of truth and reconciliation, contrasted to a refusal to acknowledge the legitimacy of the Indigenous protests to the pipeline discussion. As settlers and newcomers, we could make a bargain with Alberta, but First Nations have a very different worldview. They seek to be negotiated with nation to nation. The worldview at the federal level seems to be that they're a conquered people and must adhere to Canadian edicts. So I thought I would give two personal examples of conflicting worldviews. And as I mentioned, I grew up in northern Quebec. And at 15, I moved to Manitoba. And there I experienced the media representation of Quebec as it was then, and I think this might still hold true. But at that time, I kept wanting to say, that's not how it is in Quebec. But I had no voice. And another example from marriage, anyone that's married has experiences of different worldviews. And a long time ago, I met Tom when I was 19, and we've been married since I was 25. And I'm still discovering that our worldviews are different. So. But quite a while ago, he was trying to persuade me that I should check the oil in my car. And I thought, yeah, that's a good idea, but I'm busy today. I'll do it tomorrow. So finally, of course, the motor didn't like that at all. It wasn't a new car. So he sensed the motor in a way that I didn't, you know. And I thought, oh, now I understand why he never writes to his sisters. And it's so obvious to me that he should write to them. And I thought, yeah, aha, that his whole worldview was so different from mine. And that's why he couldn't understand what I was trying to say about you should write to your sisters. And I couldn't understand what he was trying to say about the motor. So it was like a big aha. So that's... I just said at the end, since then, that kind of woke me up, and I would ask myself, when people seem to be resistant to something, what is really different about their worldview? Like, take it to a deeper level.
Thank you, Peggy. AJ.
Hello. My name is AJ Vitti, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about my path to understanding a worldview other than my own, and that it's been a long journey. It began in university, philosophy of aesthetics, where we discussed a reading that detailed a situation in Nunavut where the Indigenous people had a much different reaction to crime than that of the Canadian government. For me, there was no debate. If you live in Canada, you must follow Canadian laws. Plain, simple, easy. That way we all live here and we're all equal. It's not about religion or beliefs. Law is neutral. Really? Asked another student. How's it neutral when most lawmakers were Christian and the laws are based on Christian values? That's when it happened. I paused and reflected. It was as if everything I had learned in grade school was unraveling. I was spinning inside, and my head literally began to hurt. I was having the very body-felt moment of my worldview beginning to shift. But it didn't stop there. In 2016, I entered a program at the JIBC called Aboriginal Focusing Oriented Therapy and Complex Trauma. We call it AFOT for short. This year-long program was designed to teach counseling from an Indigenous perspective. There I learned in circle and in ceremony. There I learned through the body instead of books. And one day, watching a film, I had another shift. We were watching a short film on residential schools made by an Indigenous director. The film follows a little girl on her journey to a residential school and some of her experiences. To our surprise, when the film was over, our instructor began to play it again from the beginning. This time, she spoke over the film, describing the values taught to this girl and how she enacted resilience because of these teachings. In one part, the little girl is riding in the car to the residential school. She is scared. She keeps looking out the window to the earth and the sky. And my instructor's voice repeats, "You are not alone." Oh my gosh, I'm going to cry. The earth is here. The sky is here. We are here for you. We will cradle you. We will heal you. I could feel the spiraling coming. Like a drop of water that floods the pool, my brain began to overflow with understanding. We talked about the earth many times in this program, but this moment came with a literal shift, and I felt myself turn my head to keep my balance. Then, just a couple of months ago, I signed up for Beacon's Truth Healing and Reconciliation series. To be honest, I signed up to support my husband, who is one of the coordinators, not because I actually thought I needed any more information on residential schools or the history of Canada. I'd been educated many times on how to feel guilt and shame about our colonial ancestry. And I went into the series guilt-ridden and worried that I was just going to be another white person in a circle of white people patting each other on the back about how good at reconciliation we are because we're not the ones that are racist or oppressing others. True. I wanted this reconciliation to include Indigenous people, hear their voices, have them guide me through the process. What I got was completely unexpected. This time my shift was one upward, like climbing the grouse grind. All that pain and suffering of the climb came with a view. As I looked outward, I understand that what I wanted was essentially to have an Indigenous person heal themselves while holding my hand so that I could feel better about myself in the process. It was ridiculous. I wanted legitimacy for an issue that I saw as Indigenous. People would ask me when I spoke up about reconciliation if I had any ancestry. Well, I don't think so, I would say, but I haven't done an ancestry test. As if that would matter. It didn't feel like I could be passionate about reconciliation, like I would just be another white person taking something away from Indigenous people. Over the series, I realized where my legitimacy lay. I am Canadian. I want to live in a place. Oh my goodness, I'm gonna cry again.
Good.
I want to live in a place that is just and fair. I am allowed to be passionate about reconciliation because my fate is tied up with those of my fellow Canadians. That is the current view after the grind. I can't wait for my next shift. Perhaps it'll be one where I can fly.
Thank you. Thank you, Peggy. Thank you, AJ. Yeah. It's about transformation. This past week, 45 Unitarians, 5 Unitarian ministers gathered at the Watch House on Burnaby Mountain to honor the spiritual stand that was taken by some of the Tsleil-Waututh members and those that believed what they believed, to stand to protect the sacred waters and coastline of this, their territory. I was proud that there were so many Unitarians that showed up, and I was deeply moved by the spiritual energy that the Watch House Keepers embodied. It was an insight into what we've been talking about here today, a lived thing. A demonstration of way of living from a worldview in which everything is sacred and alive, and that we are all hoops in this one great circle sheltered by one sacred tree. When we arrived, we were warmly welcomed by Stacy. We all brought food to share with those that had been living and tending the camp. I was first approached by Edson, who offered me tobacco and invited me to pray at the sacred fire, which is kept burning 24/7. We were graciously included in all the ritual. Before the service began, I offered tobacco to Will George, whose vision it was to build the watch house and who lives there permanently, well, at least for now, permanently. Will welcomed us and shared the story of how he built the watch house with others. He arrived late that day because he had just gotten married the day before, so we also celebrated with him. I was deeply moved by the honoring of our presence there as allies. And I hope that those who camp and pray at the Watch House could feel the reciprocal honoring and respect for their choice to be there and their spiritual commitment. This way forward for all of us is a great learning, challenges to be sure, but also wonderful discoveries and deepening into a new reality, one that holds many worldviews that are distinct and valuable and instructive, circles within circles. I invite you now to share this reading of Black Elk that I mentioned earlier with me. I'll take the first line, you take the second, where the little dots are. And I'd like to do this slowly so that these words can really sink in. Then I was standing on the highest mountain of them all. And while I stood there, I saw more than I can tell. For I was seeing in the sacred manner the shape of all things of the Spirit.
And the shapes as they must live, together like one being.
And I saw the sacred hoop of my people was one of the many hoops that make one circle, wide as daylight and starlight. To shelter all the children of one mother and one father.
And I saw that it was holy.
Amen. We're now going to sing together